This is Writer's Voice. Today we speak with two remarkable writers. First, Alice Rothschild tells us about Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. It's a powerful memoir in free verse, exploring her journey as a feminist, activist, and doctor. Then we turn to historical fiction with Grace Tiffany, whose novel, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, reimagines the life of Shakespeare's daughter Judith during the tumultuous English Civil War. Two fascinating stories, one rooted in personal history, where the personal is political, the other in literary imagination, both shedding light on the fight for justice and self-determination. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 1970, banks could require a woman applying for credit to have her husband co-sign. Employers could legally fire a woman for being pregnant. And women medical students faced harassment, abuse, and discrimination from their overwhelmingly male teachers and peers. That's the environment in which my guest, Alice Rothschild, became a doctor, a feminist, and an activist. Her wonderful memoir recounts her journey from 1950s good girl to irreverent, feisty, feminist OBGYN, forging her own direction in the sexist world of medicine. She opened an all-woman practice, worked with midwives, challenged the status quo, and contributed to the iconic manual on women's health, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Rothschild's poems are steeped in the often shocking history of medicine and the conflicted sexual politics of the second half of the 20th century. Alice Rothschild is a physician, author, and filmmaker. She practiced OBGYN for almost 40 years and served as assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Harvard Medical School. Alice Rothschild, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Inspired and Outraged. Well, this is the first book-length memoir in free verse that I have ever read, and I just want to, first of all, compliment you on, I think, such a difficult process. I mean, writing poems is extremely labor-intensive, and I just thought you did such a beautiful job with this book.
Well, actually, it came to me in poetry. So for me, it was more like the ideas came, the phrases came, the memories came, the memories led to more memories, and then it all arrived in free verse. And I would get a line that would lead to another line. I would, you know, go through diaries and old letters, and then more lines would come. So it was actually very fun to write and not as difficult, I think, as writing in prose for this particular topic. It also gave me an ability to have a wide range of, you know, seriousness, snarkiness, humor, outrage, all of the different emotions one feels, and to do it with a light brush of poetry. So it was actually fun to write.
And really fun to read as well. So this is very much a memoir of you growing up, of becoming a feminist doctor. You know, the watchword of the women's movement, the second wave of the women's movement, was the personal is political. And this book is all about the personal and the political. In your dedication, you say that the memoir is written for future generations, struggling to understand their families of origin, to find their voice and political power, and for your daughters and grandchildren. Now, you and I are contemporaries. And in reading this, I remember just how awful it was to be a girl and then a woman growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And now there are so many who want to put us right back there. Have you spoken with your children and grandchildren about this book? And if so, what was their reaction?
Well, I have spoken a lot with my daughters, and they're very excited about the book. And they are also young feminists, or now the oldest one is 40, so whatever age that is. So they're very supportive and very excited. My grandchildren are 2 and 8, so they're not quite there yet, but they're feisty. And I think that they will appreciate this book as they grow up. And I just actually yesterday had a conversation with my younger daughter because she sees a whole bunch of her friends deciding to stay home and be full-time moms. And these are accomplished, educated women who had careers. And I am not in any position to tell women how to live their lives. But I also feel like the reactions to full-time motherhood in the 1950s or the beginnings of the feminist movement. And so there's a reason why, you know, it may sound charming to be home with your children and cooking and taking care of things. And there is an ease to that, but it's also one of the hardest jobs in the world. And it also politically puts you in a position where you're totally reliant on your spouse. And women have found that that can be a problem. And so I think we need to really be smart about how we make our choices and to learn from the past.
Absolutely. And I think this book is so important for making people aware of that. But let's go back to the origins, because you also talk about family of origin. Just give us a setting, talk a little bit about your family, where they came from.
Well, my grandparents were Jews living in shtetls and little villages in Eastern Europe. And they came over in the early 1900s, you know, in the boats and steerage, without any money, without any English, and did the going through Ellis Island, living in Brooklyn, New York thing. And so that's where my origins are. And as a child, we would go to Brooklyn for all the major Jewish holidays. And so I had a big dose of what an Orthodox Jewish family is like, and then saw my mother in reaction to that as she became an adult and became more rebellious and gave up being kosher and, you know, found probably the only young man in Brooklyn who was Jewish and had not been bar mitzvahed. So I see the struggles that occurred. But I also wanted people to remember that I'm the second generation. I am part of the immigrant story. And since immigrants are so demonized these days, I thought it was very important to be grounded in what, you know, chain migration looked like in 1900s and how people came over. And so I really included that in the poetry.
And what a portrait. You moved to a Boston suburb as a child, and then you went to college at Bryn Mawr. These were places where there were very few Jews. And so talk a little bit about what it was like to, in fact, be other in the place that you grew up.
Well, the interesting thing is that my parents were running away from Brooklyn. And so they wanted to go to someplace totally different. And they found this little town in New England, south of Boston. And when we moved in, I think I was like two or three, and there were about 4,000 people in the town. And when I left at the end of my junior year of high school, 10,000 people had moved in over that time, and almost all of them were Jews. And so ironically, I was living in a small New England town that was felt very Christian, but there were a huge number of Jews. So part of my experience of growing up Jewish was I'd be in a classroom that was mostly Jewish, and we would have a Christmas tree, and we would spend December singing Christmas carols. And it was very alienating for me because I was figuring out my identity. And I got to the point where I could not make a sound when we were singing. I would mouth the words because I felt like this is not me. I am the minority person here, even though I was in a class full of Jews. So, and that was one of the things that led to this very painful experience where the Jewish parents at the town meeting in our town asked that there not be Christmas trees in every classroom. And there was a march on the town where the older townspeople accused the Jews of destroying Christmas. And it was this sort of outburst of anti-Semitism, which really marked me because I realized that I was othered and that I was a minority and that I had to pay attention to that. And even though I did not grow up to be a religious Jew, I have always felt like an outsider, you know, for a number of reasons. I mean, being a smart girl in the 50s with aspirations was a definite othering experience. And being a Jew in a small town was an othering experience. So it really marked my sense of who I am.
And that had a direct bearing, it seems to me, on your sensitivity and awareness of others. When you went to Bryn Mawr College, you say that you had a real confrontation with understanding class and race. Say a little bit more about that.
So, you know, I went to Bryn Mawr College, and the first day of orientation was on the first day of the high holidays. So I missed all of that. because I was in a temple in some suburb in Philadelphia, totally lost. And, you know, this was the first time that I met upper class girls and girls whose fathers were ambassadors. And I actually had a classmate who came up to me and said, "May I touch you? I've never met a Jew before." And I, you know, had this feeling like she was looking for my horns kind of thing. So it was a very interesting place to be. And also, I just felt like I was in, you know, Gone with the Wind. We had Black women serving us our meals, cleaning our rooms. It was very different than my experience up north in Boston. And so I had that awakening about racism, about class, about what it was like to be a public school girl when a lot of the girls were private school girls, you know, that kind of thing really also made me feel different. And at the same time, you know, I was in the midst of the movement to end the Vietnam War and trying to figure out how to be an educated woman. And all that was sort of churning in the midst of this situation at college.
Well, let's go back a little bit, though, for a moment, because I found your writing about your relationship with your mother quite, well, familiar to me. We had mothers who were both fairly narcissistic, but also loving. Obviously, she felt very, very connected to you and you to her. So it was a complicated relationship. You say that you grew up like a wild pony contained by an invisible electric fence. And I'll quote you, "marking the limits of my choices and behavior." And about your mother, you say that decades later, "I still pull out the thorns one by one, rubbing my bruised skin, trying to find a path towards forgiveness." So say more about that.
Well, my mother was, you know, loving, creative, smart. She was also a writer. And she and I were very, very close growing up. And she had 4 pregnancies in 5 years, and I was the oldest. And she always said I took care of her during her pregnancies. And I thought, well, that's kind of cute. But then I looked back at it and thought, I was like 3 years old. What was I doing taking care of my mother? So I became her best friend. And we were best friends. And I told her everything, and we shared, and we were close. And I always now, as an adult, wonder, like, where was the husband as an intimate person? Although he was there, but like, why was I her primary person? And that was a very cozy, nurturing relationship until I started having different opinions. And so I got the messaging, you're smart, you could do anything in the world, you could be anything. But of course, you're going to marry a Jewish man who's a doctor or a lawyer and have children and da, 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 da. So I didn't know about those limits until I bashed my head against them. And it really, the first bashing occurred when I fell in love with an African-American guy who was brilliant, you know, played the violin with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, was pre-med, you know, you couldn't get better than that, according to mothers. And yet she threatened to, you know, sit shiva for me and throw me out of the family if I married him. And that was like stunning to me because this was a mother who defended civil rights and worked in the inner city and all these sort of progressive things. And yet I discovered her limits by hitting them. And the punishment was very harsh. And it was very much like probably her immigrant mother would have felt, even though my bubby, my grandmother, was incredibly loving. She would not have tolerated a non-Jewish son-in-law, you know. So it was complicated. And the way I dealt with it after, you know, years of therapy and thinking about this was that I had to have very clear boundaries with her. And she hated that. And I understand why she hated that, because she felt that she got thrown out of the nest, you know, but I felt like I can't live in this nest if I'm going to be a sane, independent person. So that was very much the adult struggle we had. And so it was extremely complicated and painful, and really was part of my maturation and my of thoughts about how to be a mother and how to be different from her, because I didn't want to make her mistakes. I wanted to make my own mistakes. So that was very important to me to figure out.
How did you, or maybe just say a little bit more about that, how you translated that experience into your relationship with your own children?
Well, what I tried to do was to, first of all, understand that I'm the mother and not the friend, and that that was a very different kind of relationship, and that my job as their mother was not to put boundaries around them, but to support them in figuring out who they are and to support them in whatever they chose to do, and to have the love that I felt for them to be not related to their behaviors or their productivity or their job choices or whatever it was, their expectations, and that their lives were about their lives. They weren't so much about my life. And part of the problem with having a narcissistic mother is that everything comes down to her. And so, for instance, I was invited to give a talk at a Harvard continuing education meeting, which was very exciting for me because I was in the Harvard system, but I was not an academic person. And I was giving a talk on the relationship between hormones and psychology. And it was for psychiatrists and social workers, et cetera. And so I spent, you know, months preparing this. And I thought, you know, it'd be great if my mother came because she would love to see her daughter in a moment of victory. And so she came and it was very successful and people were very excited. And afterwards, people were clustered around me, all asking questions. We were having a wonderful discussion and my mother kind of sidles up. And so I introduce her because I'm trying to be a good daughter. And she starts talking and she immediately charms the crowd. And literally everybody turned away from me and turned to her. And I was left standing there by myself as everybody, you know, talked with my mother, who was such an interesting, fascinating person. And I was enraged. And then I realized that she could not tolerate my being in the spotlight when she was not. And even though a lot of the skill set I had was skill set that she taught me, she couldn't handle this. And that was like one of those markers like, oh, I get it. I get it. She's loving and competitive. She's giving and narcissistic. I mean, it's a very complicated thing to figure out. I mean, I basically went underground. I had a relationship with my mother that was fairly loyal, superficial. I would never be vulnerable to her, but I was present and that's what I could give her. And I had to figure out, okay, what can I give you without being destroyed by you? And that's what I could do. And, you know, I live close by. She had access to the grandchildren and that was my gift to her, but it was never enough and it was never good enough.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alice Rothschild about her memoir, Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. So let's go to the political now. You have on page 138, the facts in 1970. And I think for our audience who was not alive at that time or too young to know, right. Do you have the book with you?
Yes, yes. And this is a poem about my graduation. And so I talk a lot about the graduation. And then I have a piece on the facts. The facts. In 1970, banks could require a woman applying for credit have her husband co-sign. In 1970, employers could legally fire a woman for being pregnant. In 1970, conjugal rights meant that it was legal for a man to rape his wife. U.S. laws included housing discrimination, pay discrimination, jury exclusion for women. A husband had unilateral control of property jointly owned. A woman had half the legal rights of a man, earned 59 cents to the dollar. Help wanted ads in newspapers listed jobs separately for men, just about everything, for women, secretarial, nursing, teaching in 1970. And then I go on to talk about my class graduating in this year, and I write, the swarm buzzed and swooped on the cusp of a new world, the frenetic winged flight, blossom to blossom, sucking up nectar, breaking it down, the constant fanning of wings, evaporating liquid, creating a sweet golden liqueur to nurture the young, constructing a life of hard work, stinging when provoked. My class, a murder of crows, swooping out of a pine tree to dive bomb a predator, an avalanche of rock tumbling down a mountain, making a new path, a sisterhood forged in protest, outrage, ambition. 25 years later, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
Yes, and 1970 was also really the year that the women's movement, I think, burgeoned. And it was certainly the first year that I went to a consciousness-raising session, dragged yes. there by a friend. You know, here you get a picture of people's attitudes. I had thought these were all like harridans or women who couldn't get a man, right?
Right.
And somebody took me to a consciousness-raising meeting, and women shared their experiences, and I realized that the personal is political, and I was fully part of this movement.
Right, right. It's important. Consciousness-raising groups were very important, and important to me as well.
Now, you were a contributor to the first and subsequent editions of an absolute classic, a book that was so important to us, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Tell us about that. You were a doctor, you were an OBGYN, and I'm going to ask you a little bit about medical school too, but this was such a critical book in the women's movement.
So I was a medical student when the first edition was being written. So I was like friends with the people in the collective and kind of in functioning as a medical advisor, although, you know, what I knew about medicine was very small, but I knew more than they did about some of the medical stuff. So I got involved with sort of being in the background and advising and giving medical advice and that kind of thing, and then continued to be involved over the years. And so for me, the publication of that book and the idea that women receive healthcare in a particular political setting and that women are being not treated well and not treated respectively in a medical setting was very important for my developing my sense of how to be a doctor. So, for instance, when I was learning clinical medicine, there was a lot of patriarchy, and most, you know, almost every single attending was a man. And the attitudes towards women tended to be, you know, they're kind of hysterical, you know, they get their periods, you can't trust them, they need to be taken care of in this paternalistic kind of way, and they don't really need to have anything explained to them because how could they understand these complicated ideas? And so coming of age at a time where women were saying, this is my body, I understand it, I know it better than any health provider, and you need to listen to me and treat me respectfully and treat me as an intelligent human being, and I will decide what I want, was really critical, because that shaped how I practiced medicine for the next, you know, 40 years or whatever.
And that book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, which, yes, it talked about, you know, women's healthcare within a political concept, but it also taught women how to take real ownership over that healthcare. And that book allowed women, I think many women for the first time, certainly me, to actually examine ourselves, quote, down there, unquote.
Right, right. So, you know, that meant that when I started doing GYN exams, you know, I had pot holders on the stirrups, I had a mirror, I had a flashlight, and every woman was invited to take a look down there. And if she wanted to, she did. And if she wanted to see her cervix, she did. And for some people, this was just revelatory. And it really, when you offer the person you're helping to see what you see and to understand what you understand, it changes the power dynamic. So I was very aware when seeing women or people identified as women that there was a power dynamic that I had to pay attention to. Like, you do not walk into a room with someone lying on the table and you tower over them. You try to see them with their clothes on first. You know, all these sort of basic stuff that is messaging about who's in power, who's in control, and who's vulnerable. And obviously, a GYN exam is the most vulnerable kind of exam that a woman could have. So it's really important to pay attention to that. And when you do, it comes out much better. I mean, I had so many women that said to me, that's the first exam I've ever had that wasn't painful. And I thought, what are people doing that this is painful? And a lot of it is paying attention, respecting how fast to go and how the woman's feeling and what she's comfortable with, giving her ownership, you know, letting her look, you know, all that kind of stuff really makes a difference.
And that was a practice that you started on your own with somebody else who was with you because you weren't offered any jobs. Talk about this practice, which was nonprofit, and the first only all-woman private practice in the Boston area.
So when I was finishing my residency, you know, the men in the program, and there were only two women my year, there were two women 2 years earlier, but otherwise the program had been all male since eternity. It wasn't like any of the doctors who had educated us and had practices offered us jobs. It also was true that we wouldn't have wanted to work in their practices, but it was interesting to see who got offers and who didn't. And so the woman in the year that I was a resident and I and her husband, who was a pediatrician, and some midwives and nurse practitioners, wanted to start a practice in the inner city that was open to all kinds of people and that was located in a place where economically disadvantaged women would be able to find us. So we opened up a practice that was set up with a community board and with a nonprofit legal status, and we were salaried. And we had this combination of an office, and then we worked in several health centers in the Boston area. And so we were trying to offer healthcare to all different kinds of women in all different kinds of settings. So in the office, we had all the African American and Hispanic and various other minorities in the neighborhood all come for care. But then we had, you know, feminists from across the river in Cambridge come to care. And so we had this incredible mix. So you could be sitting in the waiting room and there would be a pregnant 14-year-old and a pregnant 40-year-old. You know, it was a very interesting blend. And we learned later that the attendings that were so-called our friends were sort of all betting how long we would last and when we would fail. Because, you know, how could these women possibly do this? And basically, we had this joke that we would close when our malpractice was greater than our salaries. So the first 2 years, I think we actually paid to work there because we weren't making much money. But once it all got going, it was a very popular practice. I actually had a number of patients who planned their pregnancies for when we opened our practice. And so we were very popular. And we were kind of the outliers, the feisty outliers. We did home birth backup. We saw all sorts of people that weren't welcomed in private practices. And when a woman, Medicaid, came into the hospital, she was our private patient if we had seen her at a health center. So we really tried to shake up the power dynamics and shake up who's considered private and who's considered public. And, you know, I was practicing at a liberal hospital, but in the postpartum ward, one floor was for private patients, which was mostly white, and one floor was for people on Medicaid, which was mostly of color. And so it was like obstetrical redlining, you know, it was very interesting once I kind of went, wait a minute, why is this? Why are people in different floors like this? And this has to do with racism and, you know, all the things that go into that. So we really tried to shake things up and we lasted 9 years. And the other thing that was hard for us was that all of us had delayed our pregnancies. So someone was always pregnant. It was hard to get partners because we weren't paying each other much money because we work in health centers that paid $24 an hour, which didn't even cover our secretary in the office. So we were in this constant struggle because we weren't small business people. And, you know, meetings, there was someone pumping, there was someone throwing up the pregnancy. Yeah, it was a challenge. And when one of us went out on maternity leave, it's not like all these nice men who trained us said, oh, let us help you. Let us take some of your coverage. In fact, people said, no, we will not cover you. Your patients are too hard, meaning either they're poor or they're educated and feminist or something. So it was a real struggle. And the hospital refused to give our midwives privileges. So they would come into the hospital, take care of women in labor. And then when the baby was about to be born, we had to race in and stand behind the curtain and, you know, watch the midwife do a perfectly lovely delivery, because that was the only way the hospital will allow the midwife to do a delivery. And yeah, so we were fighting an uphill battle. So that was the practice. And then we went to a big HMO where the on-call wasn't every other night, which was kind of killing us. And we had more coverage and we had some very, very lovely partners. So it was a very different struggle, but that was our practice.
And one of the struggles that you had is this was a time when the anti-abortion movement got pretty violent in Boston. There was an anti-abortionist who killed two people, injured five at three different abortion clinics. And two of them were, in fact, near Boston, in Brookline. And you lived in Brookline then. And you provided abortions as well. So talk about that situation and also what your 11-year-old daughter asked you on the day after that terrible assault.
Right. So I provided abortions starting in my residency. I was head of the a women's health center in Cambridge. And so on weekends, I would do abortions there. And then when I became a private doctor, I continued to do abortions, but not as much because I was doing a ton of other things. So I was very committed to reproductive choice and to providing abortion care. And so we were concerned about security, but, you know, it was kind of a vague concern. And then this horrific killing happened at an abortion center near my home and near the hospital. And I actually took care of one of the people who was a receptionist who was shot and survived. And so this was a big wake-up call, and there were protests about it and all that kind of stuff. And my daughter was very aware of what was going on because we talked about lots of things. And I was going off to work, and she said, are you going to get killed today, Mommy? And it was just like stabbing me in the heart kind of moment, because I needed to reassure her that I was not going to get killed. But I didn't 100% know if that was true, but I had to reassure her as a mother. And also, I felt like the best way to prepare my daughters was to be open about what's going on in the world at an age-appropriate place. And so it was a very powerful moment for me.
So weigh in on the situation today with, it's not just the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but also a more general assault on the reproductive rights of women, including assault on IVF, including the criminalization of miscarriage. Talk about what's going on now and what the lessons that you learned in an earlier time you feel is important for people to remember.
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a backlash to whatever strides we succeeded in making. So the fact that for several decades, abortion was fairly legal in the United States, although not that available in many parts of this country. And the fact that women wanted to have reproductive control over their bodies and their reproduction and how they did it and all that kind of stuff was very threatening, particularly to white Christian men of the MAGA variety. So what we're seeing now is backlash and an attempt to push women back basically to the 1950s, as far as I can tell. And so part of why I wrote this book is that I think it's very important for women and for men that love them and are their allies to be aware of the political context in which their life is occurring and to be aware of the history of the struggle that got them the victories they got. And also, this book is a call to action because one of the things I think we've learned quite clearly is that if we don't keep our eye on the ball and if we don't keep fighting, we're going to lose what we've gained. And that's really happening right now. So I think this is not a time to be complacent. And this is a time to be out in the streets, writing, talking, agitating for what we have won and keep the movement moving forward. And it's really, really, really under threat.
Full book. I mean, just beautifully written book, inspired and outraged. The Making of a Feminist Physician is required reading for those of us who aim to do just that. So thank you so much, Alice Rothschild, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's just been a privilege.
Well, Francesca, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Alice Rothschild. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Inspired and Outraged. Next up, a feminist novel about Shakespeare's daughter. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Little is known about William Shakespeare's younger daughter, Judith, except that she lived an exceptionally long life during one of the most turbulent times in England's history. Shakespeare scholar and novelist Grace Tiffany's first novel about Judith, My Father Had a Daughter, covered her early years up to the age of 30 when she becomes a healer and apothecary. Tiffany's sequel, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, leaps forward more than 30 years when Judith, now a venerable crone, takes on a dangerous journey in the midst of the English Civil War. It's a terrific read. And I am very happy to welcome Grace Tiffany.
Thank you.
The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter. It was just a delightful book to read. The title is a quote from Hamlet. Tell us about that title for your novel.
Well, the title is a part of a slightly longer quotation from Hamlet. It's part of Ophelia's mad babblings, Hamlet's girlfriend, after she loses her mind. And she sings little snatches of songs and roves around the court at Elsinore. And one of the things that she says or sings is, "The owl was a baker's daughter. Lord, we know what we are, but know not what we may be." And it was really the second part of the quotation that partly interested me in it as a title, because the book has so much to do with various kinds of women who are expected to perform certain roles, but end up doing some outrageous and unusual things and that they perhaps didn't know that they could do before they started doing them. So they know what they are, but they don't know what they can be. And there's also some owl connections to some other things that go on in the book. There is a character, an important one, who does happen to be a baker's daughter.
This is a second novel about Shakespeare's daughter that you've written, and you are a Shakespeare scholar. Tell us why you decided to write these two novels about Shakespeare's daughter, Judith.
Well, I got very interested in what the plays or some of them might imply about Shakespeare's own family life. And I have to stress that the plays are not a biographical blueprint for Shakespeare's family, but they invite speculation, particularly because we do know some things about Shakespeare's family. We know that he had three children and that two of them were twins, a boy and a girl. And we know that he wrote some plays about twins. We know that he lost his son, one of the twin pair, when the son was young. And he wrote a play in which the son of a pair of twins is thought lost and then is miraculously found. And there's a kind of joyful reconciliation between the lost young man and his sister. And this just seemed to invite interesting possibilities or to raise interesting possibilities for constructing a fiction related to the two twins of Shakespeare. And in my first book, I was the protagonist of both of them is Judith, who is the youngest daughter of Shakespeare, was the youngest daughter of Shakespeare, and she's the female twin. And so the first book explores her childhood and young womanhood and has a lot to do with the death of her brother. And we don't really know how it happened, but I imagine a way that it happened. And I imagine a kind of connection that she has to it, which makes her feel guilty and involves her in wanting to somehow work out that guilt. And there are ways and reasons that she blames her father for kind of complicated reasons for the loss of her brother. And she ends up getting involved with the production of the play. Well, the play is Twelfth Night. And somehow in the playing of the play and her involvement with it, she manages to kind of work through the death of her brother and somewhat come to terms with it. And I always liked Judith's story. I thought that this daughter was a good person to put into a fiction, partly because we know she existed, but we don't know very much about her other than that she was a twin who lost her sibling when she was young. But she also lived a very long life and lived through interesting times. She lived to be 77 years old. She was born in the late 16th century, lived well on into the 17th century through the reigns of Elizabeth I and a couple of the Stuart monarchs. She lived through the English Civil War. She lived through the interregnum and she lived on into the first couple of years of the restoration of the Stuart monarch to the throne. And I thought, what an interesting time that she lived in, and that I wanted to pick up her life at a later date, because the first book leaves her when she's about 30 years old. I wanted to pick her up as an older woman during the English Civil War, largely because I thought that would be another interesting context for a story to see and investigate and basically invent the things that Judith was doing then.
Yeah, and it is fascinating to learn. I found myself going to Wikipedia and looking up some of the different, you know, minor characters in that Civil War and reading about it. You decided to make her a healer, an apothecary. Why is that? And what position does she hold then in her town of Stratford, her hometown?
Well, that's one of the things that I made up. But what I didn't make up is that her brother-in-law was a physician. So that gave me the idea for her to, partly for something to do, that she has all this restless energy, at least my character does, my version of Judith. So she becomes interested in the healing arts through her brother-in-law. This is back in the first novel, and becomes his assistant and then eventually becomes, you know, fairly expert surgeon herself, which is unlikely for a woman in the 17th century, but not unheard of, particularly women when they served as healers. They would have been midwives and kind of herbalists. So she does that kind of thing too. But that was partly having created that identity for Judith in the first book. It was convenient for the second one, too, for the owl was a baker's daughter, because it takes place during the English Civil War, when there are battlefields, you know, within range of her home, and England is divided and torn up, and, you know, people are marching off to war and getting injured. So her skills are called into service, and she ends up serving at first locally at a real battlefield. It was an actual historical battle near Stratford, and then kind of continues in that vein. Events result in her, you know, finding herself in particular situations where she's caring for injured soldiers.
You know, this is a kind of almost picaresque novel. I mean, she goes on on a journey, at least in part because she's in danger in Stratford. Why is that? And is that something that she actually might have faced, being a midwife and a healer?
If she had been, that was a danger for women in general, particularly in rural areas who practiced healing arts, that they're always, especially as you become older women, you know, there's sort of superstitions about witchcraft, and say something went wrong with a kind of healing intervention or a birth, and you would, and you irritated your neighbor in some way, you know, you would stand in danger of such an accusation. So that is actually a real historical danger that women sometimes faced. And I invented a situation of that sort for Judith, in which she does precipitate suspicion because something does go wrong as a result of a birthing which she administers. And partly that, and partly the fact that she has joined forces with a kind of unusual servant who is a zealous Puritan, who is behaves in unseemly ways, and she breaks out in prayer in all kinds of times and strange times. And so it was partly then her connection with this woman and with this kind of strange, eerie child who's the woman's niece that they travel around with, and bizarre antics that the niece gets up to, that Judith then becomes endangered by the possible threat of an accusation of witchcraft. So she flees the town of Stratford, and other adventures begin. And this is the part where I think picaresque is kind of a good word for it, where she goes on the road and she ends up back in London, then she comes back, and lots of things happen to her along the way. Largely, the threat of the witchcraft accusation, although I found it interesting, but it was a way to get her out of town also, because I wanted her on the road and I wanted her to meet up with some of the people that she meets up with, and, you know, for other things to happen to her that weren't going to happen in Stratford.
Well, we'll talk in a minute about her two companions, Grace Tiffany, but the novel, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, as we've said, takes place during the English Civil War. So for us ignorant Americans, tell us about that time.
Yeah, that's something that I think a lot of Americans don't know very much about. But England had its civil war. I guess it would have been a couple hundred years, 100 years before our civil war. And the war was a religious and political conflict. What precipitated it was a rivalry between King Charles I, the second Stuart monarch, and a parliament that disliked the authoritarian way that he was governing, so that he suspended parliament and attempted to rule without their consultation, to tax people directly, to ignore some of the traditional privileges enjoyed by the commons and the House of Lords, but mostly the House of Commons. Should not be too difficult for Americans at the present moment to imagine a rather high-handed head of state who ignores a legislative body. But this was the case 400 years ago in England, and Parliament became increasingly militant and had its own army, or raised its own army, and declared war on the king, and declared that it was his fault, that he had started it by departing from his traditional role, which was powerful but should have been limited. So the king had his armies, the royalist supporters, mostly aristocrats, but not entirely, and the Parliament had theirs, led ultimately famously by Oliver Cromwell, the New Model Army. And the war lasted, the period that they call the interregnum was almost 20 years long. And what that means is between reigns of kings, where Parliament ruled without a king. The war itself was, I think, a bit less than 10 years long. Parliament won. And I don't want to include too many spoilers here, but this is famous historical knowledge that Charles I was executed for his high-handed ways. But I mean, eventually everybody knows that England has a king now, so that they got a king back. But that episode in English history was crucial to a radical reduction of royal powers, so that when the king was restored, and that's a part of history that doesn't come into my novel because it ends in the middle of the interregnum. But when the king was restored to the throne, he knew better than to act like Charles I had, let's put it that way.
Well, it might not be a bad idea for Congress to take a bit of the example of Parliament and raise some of its own enforcers.
Yeah, to notice its power and use it in some way. What happens in my book is that Judith doesn't want to take sides, and England is divided as peoples become in the time of civil war between royalist supporters of Charles and the supporters of Parliament. And she has these divisions in her own family, which is maybe something else that Americans can relate to now. She tries to stay neutral. She just doesn't like the war. She doesn't like the violence, but she gets caught up in the events anyway. And part of the story involves her. She actually ends up meeting the king in this interesting way that is a mixture of fact and fantasy on my part. But she ends up beginning to understand the rebellion. I don't want to call it a rebellion, but the war against him more, that she feels that England has moved on beyond any kind of time where a king can be idolized or set himself up as a kind of all-powerful figure in the way that Charles I tried to do. So she kind of moves a little bit towards the parliamentarian side by the end of the story.
It's so interesting. And, you know, you mentioned the woman who goes along with her, a young woman named Jane, with her niece of 6, whose name is Pearl. Jane is, let's say, a devout Puritan, a kind of woman warrior. Talk about Jane and her Puritanism, because this was something I didn't know. I mean, I always thought the Puritans were kind of a minor sect. That's why they had to come over here. But clearly, they were a major force. And Oliver Cromwell, he wasn't a Puritan, but
he was.
He was a Puritan. Okay, so talk about the Puritans, how they outlawed the theater, they outlawed gambling, you know, there's a kind of theocratic state.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question, because we tend in America to associate Puritans with the New England settlers, with the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving and all that stuff. And there is that connection. But Puritans, as the name suggests, were really centrally about purifying, as they saw it, the English church. So the ones who came over to America were separatists who wanted to, there were various kinds of these, and they had various ways of worshiping. But overall, they wanted to do it apart from the English church because they felt oppressed by it. The Puritans in England wanted to remake the church. They wanted to get rid of its hierarchical system. They didn't like the bishops. There were various kinds of Puritans in England, too, and they kind of fragmented off and broke into different groups. And the Scottish Presbyterians were different from the English independents. But basically, they were in favor of more of a kind of congregationalism, where local assemblies made religious decisions and communities were more involved and more powerful in the church. And they didn't like a system of bishops and archbishops where theology was kind of handed down from above. But they were also, I don't want to succumb to cliches about Puritans, because they weren't all unsmiling, killjoy sort of people. But it's true that they protested against, and once they got control of Parliament, worked to eradicate and outlaw a lot of public entertainments. And this happened earlier in the century, or began to happen earlier in the century, entertainments that they thought were decadent and immoral. And among the institutions that were subject to this kind of legislation were the playhouses. And they were shut down. They were generally considered to be chapels of Satan, where all kinds of immoral things were dramatized, and it had unhealthy effects on audiences. There were some plays that were still allowed to be performed, but in general, Shakespeare's plays weren't going to be performed during this period. Christopher Marlowe's plays, are not going to be performed. So there was a lot of strict legislation of public entertainments and attempts to reform society according to a sort of strict biblical guidelines as interpreted by these Puritans. And that didn't last. That's never going to last. But they were in the middle of the century. That was a time when, a lot of this was happening and governing the life that people experienced, particularly in the cities, the cultural centers like London, where Judith ends up for a large part of the story.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with Grace Tiffany about her new novel about Shakespeare's daughter, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter. So talk about Jane, too. She's a Puritan. You would think a Puritan woman would be subservient, but she's anything but. She is a holy warrior.
Yeah, she is. And she's kind of an eccentric person, and probably, she's not meant to be a representative of the standard Puritan zealot of the time, but she is very religiously inspired. She's quoting the Bible all the time. She has a couple of brothers who have died on various battlefields, and she carries the armor of one of them around with her wherever she goes, and until she ultimately finds a use for it. And she ends up being a maid servant of Judas, and that's how they end up being connected. She comes to her door looking for work, and she has a kind of connection to the family, and so they end up together. And I guess partly through Jane, I wanted to burst a cliche of Puritans as not being fun people, because they were kind of fun in their own way. Her energy comes and her joy comes from Scripture. It comes from the Bible. It comes from, riding off to war and kind of fighting evil as she sees it. And she goes to church services and she gets all into it. And there is, though, a part of the story, which I hope is kind of funny, where she kind of mixes up. She thinks she's quoting the Bible, but she actually ends up quoting some lines from Shakespeare. And of course, she's the faction that believes that these kind of non-biblical plays or non-religious plays are immoral. So it's funny that she doesn't even realize that she's quoting from Shakespeare and she's mixing it up with the Bible, which a lot of people do, because Shakespeare's plays, not only do they quote the Bible a lot, but they are of the same time period as the King James Bible, which is the most well-known Bible in English. And a lot of times you're not really sure, is this Shakespeare? Is this Bible? But she gets corrected by Judith, and Jane is insisting that what she's saying is Scripture. And Judith say, well, no, it's from one of those evil, immoral plays that you don't want being performed. Yeah, I don't know where the character of Jane came from, much less her crazy niece, Pearl, the little six-year-old that causes so much trouble, but they just kind of appeared in my imagination. And so the story is as much about them. They become Judith's traveling companions, as well as the ones who help her get into trouble and need to travel. But they're very, very much at the center of the book. The little girl, Pearl, Pearl is short for one of these Puritan names. Her full name is Pearl of Great Price, which comes from the Bible somewhere. It's really true that Puritans would name their children after spiritual values like tribulation or woman of mercy or things like that. So So she's got a very puritanical name, Pearl does.
Yeah, she's a great character as well. There was one part that I was also very interested in to learn more about, and that is when Judith is in London, she's hoping to work as an apothecary, as a doctor, basically. But even though she has all the requisite licenses, all of a sudden she has to practice under a doctor. Is this when that changed, that women had to subjugate themselves to the being overseen by doctors, or did that come later?
It is true that in the early modern period, that again, more in urban areas than out in the country, that male physicians had various ways of trying to assert control over the practice of medicine. And even though I invented that particular scene, I mean, I don't know exactly what kind of license you would need to have, but I wanted to reflect that in Judith's experience when she comes to London. I mean, having practiced for 30 years as an apothecary and a midwife in Stratford, and even having certain documents to demonstrate if she has a license, which is good enough in Stratford, but it's not good enough in London, apparently. And so she gets told, sorry, you know, you can't legally do this here. But she finds a way to do it anyway. And of course, there are other reasons in the plot, you know, having to do with that circumstance that I wanted her to have to go underground, because it's in this underworld where she decides she's just going to, you know, she's going to practice without a license. And where is she going to practice without a license? She's going to practice her craft or her skill among the disreputable, among the people who are living illegal lives in London, players who are staging illegal plays, prostitutes who are getting pregnant and having babies. And so she seeks them out, and she kind of feels a little bit at home with them anyway, because she's sort of a wild person herself. But that's the world that she seeks out and finds. And it's in this world that she reconnects with a person who was important to her in her youth when she was in London, and another part of the story begins.
Yes, the love story part.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It was just one of those thoroughly enjoyable books to read in which I also learned a lot, but with total ease.
Thank you.
Grace Tiffany, thank you so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Grace Tiffany is the author of 7 novels, including My Father Had a Daughter, her first novel about Shakespeare's daughter, Judith. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from the sequel, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Amanda Becker about her book, You Must Stand Up, The Fight for Abortion Rights in Post-Dobbs America. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.